It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Have you tried shopping for guidebooks? There's a zillion out there. Well, today we learn how to scope out the guides with Richard Sterling from The Lonely Planet. His take is travel for the hungry and adventurous, like the Saigon restaurant where you have to duck the swinging cobras. Back home, Jane and Michael Stern take us to Pennsylvania Dutch country. We talk Copper River salmon, chef Anthony Bourdain, author of Kitchen Confidential Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, is in Tokyo with a mission. We go to L.A. for the Getty Museum's Edible Monument Show, and we're opening the lines for your calls. All this coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about what to do with a can of tuna fish that's not tuna noodle casserole. I've got some easy ideas for canned tuna fish, plus traditions borrowed from France, Italy, and a couple of home kitchens. First, let's buy the tuna. My favorite tuna is packed in olive oil, especially if it's imported from Spain or Italy. Now, in those countries, canning tuna is high art. And this is probably the reason why canned tuna fish is the new darling of food lovers. There are some amazingly good canned or jarred tunas out there. They can be like eating a good steak and cost just about as much. If you're in the mood to blow $7 to $10 for a 6-ounce can of tuna and want to taste something really special, look for brands like As do Mar, Ortiz, and Calippo. Far less expensive oil-packed tuna is sold by Genoa, Progresso, and even Starkist. One thing about really great tuna, it is like steak. I mean, each bite is wonderful. So if you're going to spend the money, serve it just the way you would fine meat, with just a simple green salad on the side and a few wedges of lemon. Okay, let's face it, though. Between the cost of this great tuna and the fact that everyone is so fat-obsessed these days, the water-packed tuna is probably what you're going to find in most stores. My vote goes for solid white albacore. It tastes fine. It's got a nice texture to it. You know, it has a real bite. And as far as supermarket brands go, Starkist and Chicken of the Sea are pretty reliable. Just be sure that there is a dolphin on the can. This means the tuna has not been caught in a way that harms dolphins. Now for some ideas of what to do with that can of tuna. When it comes to great tuna fish salad sandwiches, forget all the fancy stuff that you see in the delis. This is the best way you do a tuna fish salad sandwich. You take some minced onion, you marinate it in the juice of half a lemon, you mince up a stalk of celery, you add a 7 or 6 ounce can of well-drained tuna, and then you add about 2 to 4 tablespoons of real mayo. Now, please, none of that low-fat stuff. It ruins the salad. Work that all together with a fork. Now for the secret of a great tuna fish salad. You have to mellow it. Age it. Chill it for at least 2 hours in the fridge. Then you make your sandwiches. I like mine on a hard roll or on whole wheat bread that's been sweetened with just a little honey. I know there are folks out there who feel that anything other than squishy white bread ruins the sandwich. And to them I say, okay, have at it. One killer tuna salad is my friend Sally's. She takes 2 cans of water-packed tuna, 2 chunked-up tomatoes, a handful of Kalamata black olives, another small handful of capers, and some chopped red onion. She adds to that a generous amount of olive oil, lemon juice, and lots of fresh dill. You mix everything together, and you've got dinner. I think the only thing I'd change is I'd use that oil-packed tuna. The classic tuna salad from the south of France is Salade Niçoise. Tuna from the can here really shines. Never would you do a Salade Niçoise with fresh fish. Okay, but this is what you actually do. Slice up tomatoes, radishes, some sweet peppers, and coarse chopped hard-cooked eggs. Add black olives, the little ones from Nice, some anchovies, and some chives. Then put the tuna over that, dress it with olive oil, and you're there. Now, in France, there's a lot of debate over whether salad greens or potatoes belong in a true niçoise. But if you go to Italy, nobody really cares. The thing you'll find mixed with tuna there are beans of all sorts, like cannellini, chickpeas, pinto beans, anything you'd like. Maybe a little onion and always olive oil. So try some new ideas with a can of tuna fish and join us again for the next Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials, 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality, heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. It's a travel show of sorts today. If you've shopped for a guidebook lately, you know the problem. So many books, so little room in the suitcase. So today we learn how to check out guidebooks with a man who writes them. Richard Sterling has written two food guides for the Lonely Planet series. And, like all Lonely Planet authors, he's got a taste for adventure. This is Eating Off That Beaten Track. We learn about the greatest salmon of them all, the Copper River salmon, from fish expert John Rowley. Keep your eyes peeled because these are going to start showing up in the market soon and at a hefty price. Are they worth it? We'll find out. We travel with Chef Anthony Bourdain, author of Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. He's a man with a mission, an American opening a French bistro in Tokyo. We go to L.A. for a study in outrageous pretension, the Getty Museum's Edible Monument Show. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane and Michael, where have you been roaming?
We've been in Pennsylvania Dutch country.
Oh, boy.
And this is a touchy subject. Michael, I think Michael has Amish phobia and I have Amish philia. I have this endless fascination with anything Amish. You know, I see a buggy and a mule and I'm, you know, in seventh heaven. All Michael sees is this, you know, sort of once wonderfully unspoiled country that is now, you know, filled with tchotchkes and billboards and, you know, you buy an Amish bonnet for, you know, $3.95. So whenever we get to Pennsylvania Dutch country, we instantly start fighting because Michael's always telling me we will never find a place to eat, that there is no such thing as real Amish food anymore. And, you know, hope springs eternal in my camp, and I'm always convinced that we're going to find a place to eat, and I won this time. I'm happy to say.
Well, you sort of won, because the place that we found, the Akron restaurant, which began as the Akron Diner back in 1954, looks like, well, how can I put it delicately? It looks like a great big tourist attraction with a gift shop. It's the kind of place where waitresses send their orders to the kitchen on a video monitor. There are little souvenirs for the kids to play with at the table.
It's not the kind of charming, folksy place that we want to find.
However,
it is not the plain people at their finest.
However, Jane is right. The food at the Akron restaurant is unbelievably unadulterated and authentic.
For instance, when we got there, the special of the day was
pig stomach stuffed.
Filled pig stomach.
Who could resist?
Not something you're going to find at McDonald's.
Certainly not, and probably not a major seller, although who knows, maybe it was.
Oh, it was flying out of the kitchen.
It was the special of the day, and all around us people were eating filled pig stomach, which, I mean, just in case somebody doesn't know, I mean, it's not an entire stomach on your plate. It's a slice of a pig stomach, so that the outside is kind of a crisp membrane,
uh-huh.
And the inside is stuffed with, like, pork, potatoes, onions, and seasonings. It's actually a very mild and kind of comfort food meal.
It's sort of like Scottish haggis or haggis. I never know quite how to pronounce it, but without the Robert Burnsian romance to it.
But on the side of your stomach, you can get all sorts.
The side of your stomach.
On the side of a stomach, you can order all sorts of truly authentic Pennsylvania Dutch side dishes. You know, the famous seven sweets and seven sours type of things.
I mean, we got in these wonderful little side dishes, we got made at the Akron restaurant, rhubarb sauce to put over it. We got baked cream pudding, which was delicious, home put up beets, lettuce salad with warm bacon dressing, a really dynamite pepper cabbage, like a coleslaw with lots of peppers, and buttered beets. And then for dessert, we had a wet bottom shoe fly pie and a red velvet layer cake.
Sounds incredible.
And we put it all on our credit card.
And I bought a lot of souvenirs. And a bonnet.
And went out to the spacious parking lot outside and drove away.
In our buggy. Our mule.
So video monitors notwithstanding, the Akron restaurant really does a great job.
The food is the real thing, no doubt about it.
Great. Oh, hey, guys, thanks.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I don't believe in fretting or grieving. Why mess around with strife? I never was cut out to step and strut out. Give me the simple life. Some find it pleasant dining on pheasant. Those things roll off my mind. Just serve me tomatoes and mashed potatoes. Give me the simple life.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them here every week, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. The time is upon us once again. Beautiful, rosy fillets of Copper River salmon will be hawked from Poughkeepsie to Pasadena at a premium price, I may add. So what's the story? Supposedly, Copper River salmon is pretty incredible eating. Well, we've got with us John Rowley, the man who brought Copper River salmon to the world. After attending Reed College, John began his career as a commercial fisherman in Alaska. Today, he's considered one of the nation's seafood experts. John, good to talk to you.
Glad to be here, Lynn.
So, John, what in heaven's name is Copper River salmon?
Well, the Copper River is a 300-mile river that runs through these incredibly rugged, majestic, beautiful mountains up in the Gulf, into the Gulf of Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And it's there's a race of king salmon in that river that are just have these wonderful genetic attributes that translate into this incredible flavor and mouthfeel when you're eating them.
You mean there is a separate race of salmon in that river?
Well, each river, each tributary has fish that have their own genetic makeup.
Huh.
And so you go from when you're dealing with wild salmon, you go from river to river, and you get even though they're the same species of fish, they can taste very differently and feel differently in your mouth. And all of this fish used to go into cans, but in 1983, I suggested to the fishermen up there, a few of the fishermen, that this fish could have a brilliant future in the marketplace, but that it needed some handling procedures on the boats that were different than what they were doing at that time. And so we did a little experimental program back in 1983. And then it was immediately, people that tasted it, the first fish that came down there was very clear to everybody that was involved with this experiment that this fish did indeed have a brilliant future in the marketplace.
So now, why do we eat them now? Why do we eat them in the spring?
Well, now is the time when the salmon return to spawn. It's a very poignant story. The salmon spawn in freshwater and live in saltwater, and they leave as little fish and go out to the high seas and feed for some years and come back to the exact same spot where they were born, and how they find that river and that ancestral gravel is a great mystery. But now is the time when they're about ready to return, and then there's a commercial fishery outside the mouth of the Copper River, you know, just when the fish begin to enter.
Copper River salmon has begun to gain a name for itself, but is it going to be fished out?
You're right. It's something that's caught on. It's got an incredible, it's developing incredible following all over the country. It's a lot of excitement this time of year. The fish is very well, the fishery is very well managed mm-hmm. by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They have a sonar on the river that counts up-migrating fish, and when there's, they'll only allow fishing if so many fish have escaped up the river for spawning. So they fish on Monday, and then they'll shut it down, and, you know, for some days, and then they'll open it up on Thursday, and it goes follows that pattern until, you know, through the season, which ends, which kind of trails off about the middle of June. So we're looking about 3 or 4 weeks of availability of this fish.
John, how should we be eating this salmon?
Simply, very simply. There's so much flavor packed into this fish that you don't want to do much for it. Just subject it to a fire or some heat to where you get some burnishing on the surface.
Uh-huh.
And then drink an Oregon Pinot Noir with it. If you can imagine breaking a deck of cards in two.
Yeah.
And then shuffling them.
Uh-huh.
The layers of flavor in this salmon and the layers of that fruit in those Oregon Pinot Noirs, they just go together in your mouth like those cards will, you know, when you shuffle them back together. And it's just an incredible combination. I think it's the best food and wine pairing that, you know, you're ever going to find.
Well, we've got our weekend assignment. John, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Fish expert John Rowley consults for farmers and food producers and is working on a book about agriculture and flavor. You can get information on Copper River salmon on our website at splendidtable.org. And since I believe you have to taste Copper River salmon to believe it, I've created a recipe for simple pan-roasted salmon. Use it for any good fresh salmon, but if you can get the Copper River, all the better. It's on the website. Speaking of exceptional, there's something else you'll find on our website at the Splendid Table store. In honor of Mother's and Father's Day, we're equal opportunity eaters here, I asked our chocolatier, Brian McElrath, to whip up something special. He came through with chocolate almond toffee. When he gave me a taste of this stuff, I lost it. It's like little briquettes, crackly and crunchy, and they've got these toasted almonds stuck in the chocolate. It's around only for a little bit of time. And because we're public radio, all the proceeds go to support the show. Coming up, a guide to travel books and adventures in eating, a chef's mission to Tokyo, and your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Ah, 'tis the season for guidebooks. Everyone's planning a trip these days. So how do you select the right guide for the way you like to travel? We decided to talk with the Indiana Jones of food, Richard Sterling. He's a travel and food writer with a strong sense of adventure. Richard has authored 3 travel books and has most recently written the Lonely Planet food guides, one for Spain and one for Vietnam, which are not your typical guidebooks. They are books for the food-obsessed travelers among us. Richard, hello.
Hi.
So, Richard, why the name Lonely Planet? I mean, let's face it, this is not the most enticing image for travelers.
Tony Wheeler, the publisher, had a favorite song many years ago by Rod Stewart. And in the lyrics, Stewart says, "Lovely planet." And Tony misheard that. He thought it was Lonely Planet. It just stuck.
The guidebooks are rather different from most. I mean, what are the origins of the guidebooks?
The origins of the guidebook were travel notes that Tony and Maureen Wheeler kept on a very early journey through Southeast Asia. And they put them all together, and they called it Southeast Asia on a Shoestring. It was very popular immediately, and things just grew from there.
Now, on a Shoestring is the running theme here.
Yeah, and traditionally, Lonely Planet has appealed to the budget traveler of all kinds, not just the backpacker, but people who want to have a good time, travel the world, and not have to mortgage the house and the kids.
So what do you think people should look for in a guidebook?
What they should look for in a guidebook? Well, they should look for my name on the frontispiece.
After that, what should they look for in a guidebook?
They need to look for the kinds of guidebooks that are written for their kinds of journeys. You know, I like to think of a guidebook as the ultimate process of elimination. No guidebook can contain all the traveler's information for a given place. So you need to determine what kind of travel you want to make and then choose your guidebook accordingly. And sometimes you need to have more than one guidebook.
So, Richard, why has Lonely Planet taken on these food guides?
Oh, I think a couple of reasons. One is that geographically, Lonely Planet has covered the Earth. We have every country in the world except North Korea, but we do have Antarctica, and there's no place left to go. So we're working on themed guides now. In addition to food, for example, we have walking guides and scuba diving guides. But food is something that everybody is interested in. I mean, not everybody scuba dives, but everybody eats.
So, Richard, you've written 2 guides. Which ones are those?
I've written Spain and Vietnam.
How do you gather information?
I have a long association with the countries that I write about, so I've got a background already. And then I go to all kinds of people like monasteries and convents, for example, have surprisingly good sources of information, particularly with things gastronomic. They often have very good cooks in them. And then, of course, I talk to restaurant chefs. I talk to housewives. And I eat my way through the country.
Uh-huh. Well, now, you're considered to be the Indiana Jones of travel food writing. What about some adventures that stand out in your mind as you were researching?
I always have adventures, Lynn. That's why I do this. Well, I think my most adventurous little tidbit from my last journey was in Vietnam, where I went to what many expatriates call the endangered species restaurant. They're not really endangered. They're just exotic. For example, I ordered a dish of king cobra. And I thought that they would cook a cobra and they would bring me a dish of it. But No. They brought a live, 7-foot, thrashing, protesting Indian king cobra to my table. The handler held it by the tail and worked it like a cowboy does a lariat. And all of the restaurant patrons were shouting bravo or cheering him on. And the jaws of this beast are just like inches from my face as he skillfully works his little lariat of death. I was not very happy. And my interpreter, the diminutive little Miss Tron, she saw my discomfort. She leaned forward, whispered in my ear, "Don't worry. This handler is very good. He's only been bitten twice."
What about the patrons who have been bitten, for goodness sakes?
I said, "What about me? I don't even want to be bitten once." And she said, "Again, don't worry. There's a complete aid station in the kitchen, and a hospital is nearby."
Okay, so is it in the guidebook?
It's in the guidebook. It's in my World Food Vietnam, yes.
When they bring out the cobra?
Sit very still, very still.
Richard, thank you.
My pleasure.
Sterling is author of The Lonely Planet Food Guides on Vietnam and Spain. You can get information on the books on our website, splendidtable.org. We have a bit of a travel tale for you. Chef and author Anthony Bourdain heads halfway around the world and down countless back alleys to help a French chef in Tokyo make traditional French food the way it's done in New York.
Brasserie Layal is a much-loved New York City restaurant, serving authentic French working man's fare like steak frites, cassoulet, pied cochon, and so on to hordes of diners each night. I am, and have been since September 98, the chef de cuisine of the original flagship operation on Park Avenue South. Though I'm an American and a New Yorker by birth, my masters, Frenchman Philippe Lajeunie and Portuguese Francophile José de Morales, seem convinced enough of my mystical connection to the French soul food they adore that they've assigned me the task of visiting our newest and most far-flung outpost, Brasserie Layal Tokyo, to advise its French chef on the cooking and presentation of French food. A daunting and unusual assignment. My mission, in short? Make the food look and taste like it does in New York, says Philippe, handing me my plane tickets. I feel like Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now.
One, two, three, four.
April 10, 11:30 a.m., departure gate bar. Last stop for degenerate smokers. An MP headed for South Korea to pick up a prisoner slams back another Brooklyn lager and grimly describes the horror of economy class to the other side of the world. He too shakes his head, resigned to his fate. An Aussie with a 5-hour layover on the other end advises me to have another beer, at least. There's nothing to do but sleep, mate, he says. April 11th. Tokyo, Roppongi District. The city of Tokyo is an absolutely amazing sprawl of industrial structures, canals, villages, and office buildings, which seem to go on forever. It's getting dark as I arrive. Philippe, my boss, has arrived the day earlier and meets me outside the restaurant with borrowed bicycles. We load my luggage onto the handlebars, and he leads me through dark, crowded, and twisting back streets to the small apartment complex where I am to stay. Roppongi District is international in character, like an Asian Georgetown. and Brasserie Leal Tokyo looks much like its older brother in New York City, though spanking new and impeccably surgically clean. Leal in New York is loved for its smoke-stained walls, creaky chairs, weathered wooden bar. Leal Tokyo is shiny and undamaged and kept that way. Everyone, managers, busboys, bartenders, dishwashers, waiters, and cooks, cleans all the time. A drainage canal runs under a grate around all the kitchen stations, water constantly flushing away debris and dirt. Work tables are lower, as are the range hoods. I'm 6'4" and bang my head almost immediately. I'm introduced to the chef and his crew. Fortunately, the common language in the kitchen is French, which I discover I can still speak and understand. April 12, 7 a.m., Roppongi. Wake up early. Speaking no Japanese and totally unprepared for the culture shock, I hesitate before my first morning out on my own. I have not yet had the nerve to squeeze into any of the crowded, delicious-smelling noodle shops where Japanese businessmen sit cheek by jowl, happily slurping down bowls of soba. I'm ashamed of myself. I wander the streets for a while, head pounding, and God help me, I settle for Starbucks. At least they let you smoke here. It's drizzling outside, and I sip my coffee and watch sailor-suited schoolgirls walk by. Damn it, I'm hungry, and there is no way I'm eating my first meal at Starbucks. I summon the courage, push back the banner in front of a tiny shop, slide back the door, plunk myself down on a stool, and order a bowl of noodles, pork, rice, and pickles. I point at another customer's plate and say dozo a lot. It seems to work, and this method of ordering will become my modus operandi over the next week. April 13, midday, Leal Tokyo. Well, never before have I had an entire room full of people bowing to me in unison. I could get used to this. Portions are smaller here, much smaller. The Japanese public is resistant to intimidating piles of côte de bœuf and frites. Back in Leal Tokyo kitchen, I take this to heart. The chef and the crew, we set to work scaling down the appearance of some of the dishes. I talk extensively with the chef about availability of products here, and I agree to send him jambon de Paris, saucisson sec, and prosciutto de Parme next time we send out an order from New York. Fish and produce can be very expensive here. A gift of a melon implies a life of obligation, and there is the potato problem. We take our frites very seriously at Leal, and the Japanese potatoes have an unusual sugar starch content that requires blanching in water. I suggest peanut instead of canola oil to the chef, and I'm advised that one could rent an apartment for what it costs here to fill a fryer with peanut oil. After food is plated, it is hand-carried to an outer service bar for pickup by the waiters. The chef garde-manger, who doubles as the pastry man, is situated in the outer service area cold station and is required out of custom to shriek welcome in Japanese along with the waiters, bartenders, and manager to all arriving customers. This can be quite alarming to visiting newcomers like myself, especially with my brain poached by jet lag. And the process is repeated on departure with the ubiquitous arigato gozaimashimashita, making me want to leap out of my skin. 9 p.m., Roppongi. My boss, Philippe, takes me out for the most incredible meal of my life. He grins mischievously all the way there. He's seen how I'm digging Tokyo, and he knows that this place we're headed, one of the best in town, will blow my mind. He's right. April 14th, 4:30 a.m., Tsukiji Fish Market. My life as a chef will never be the same again. The colors here alone, I never expected such psychedelic hues to exist outside of hallucinations. The variety, the strangeness, the sheer volume of seafood available in Tsukiji's central fish market is a colossal terror dome of mind-boggling dimensions. Scallops in snowshoe-sized black shells, fish still twitching and spitting in pans of water and ice, eels pinned to boards and filleted alive, periwinkles, cockles, encyclopedic selections of roes, salted, pickled, cured, fresh, everywhere fish still bent with rigor mortis, porgy, sardines, swordfish, abalone, spiny lobsters, oysters, blowfish, bonito, and tuna. Tuna sold and grated like gems. frost-covered 200 to 300-pound tunas stacked everywhere like stone figures on Easter Island. There are sea urchins, egg sacs, fish from all over the world, giant squid as long as an arm, baby squid the size of a thumbnail. This is the only place in Tokyo where the Japanese will actually nudge you out of the way. The people here are busy, in a hurry. In the middle of all this, you can barely smell fish. Only salt water and the cigarettes of the fishmongers. April 16th, evening, Shibuya District. Philippe takes me out for a last meal in Tokyo. I'm heartbroken at having to leave. I'm getting good at this city now. Shibuya is Times Square multiplied by 50. We wander through unbelievably crowded streets, passing neon signs, punky kids, and drunken businessmen. It is, apparently, okay here to get wildly drunk with the boss and your coworkers and then vomit on their shoes. Everybody's doing it. Beautiful young women drag their inebriated boyfriends to the subway. In a tatami room off a crowded, neon-lit rabbit warren of streets, bars, restaurants, and clubs, we eat shabu-shabu, an intimidating Everest-sized heap of vegetables, fish, noodles, and meat, cooked in stages by an attendant in a hot wok filled with broth. We are the only gaijin in the place and start with iced sake first, followed by another discovery, hot sake, containing grilled fish bones. The waitress ignites the fish oil that collects on the top, and we drink it immediately. It's heady, wonderful stuff, and we attack the mountain of food until it's all gone. I do not want to leave tomorrow. Fueled by the hot, smoky sake and digging through the broth for the last slice of scallop, I'm considering burning my passport and disappearing into the mysterious east. I call New York later, still feeling the effects of the hot sake, and run this idea past my wife, who is less than enthusiastic. Apparently, the idea of me shedding my identity, learning to speak Japanese, and abandoning my life in New York does not sound like a reasonable thing to do right now. I'm informed of a recently acquired box of Krispy Kreme donuts and a fresh batch of Bialys from Columbia Bagels, laid in for my scheduled return. I stagger back to my apartment to pack.
Anthony Bourdain is author of the newly published Kitchen Confidential: Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. The article, Mission to Tokyo, first appeared in Food Arts magazine. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia question. This week the question is, where did the expression small fry come from? You know, as in they're just small fry, meaning not very important, or meaning to be very young. So again, the question this week is, where did the expression small fry come from? We'll be back in a moment with that answer, edible monuments at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and your calls. So get to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're taking your calls in a moment, so get on the line, 800-537-5252. But before we launch into your questions, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, where did the expression small fry come from? Well, apparently the saying small fry comes from the life cycle of the salmon. Fry is what a tiny infant salmon is called. You know the story. Adult salmon fight their way upstream to lay their eggs in the gravel they were born in. Well, when those eggs hatch, they're not even as long as your pinky nail. They've got this little yellow sac for a belly. And the little fish hide in the gravel until that's digested. This is their first food source. Then the tiny salmons come out of the gravel to search for more food. At this point, they become fry. So there's the expression, small fry. You know, salmon are amazing. Did you know that when the little fish finally start to work their way downstream, searching for the sea, their blood and respiratory systems change so that they can live in salt water instead of in the fresh water where they were born? And another amazing piece of salmon trivia is that the North Atlantic salmon can leap, listen to this, 15 feet in the air. It's quite a fish. Talk about athletic. The lines are officially open. Get to those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's talk. Anything goes. We're going to go right to the phones. We have Alan on the line. So, Alan, what's on your mind?
Okay. I was trying to find a recipe to make a red pickled tomato.
A red pickled tomato.
The only place I'm aware that they're available is at a pickle stand on the Lower East Side of New York. Can I name the stand?
Sure you can. We name names. We're public radio.
Okay. It is Gus's Pickles.
Gosh, I've heard of Gus's Pickles.
And they are wonderful, but I've never found a recipe to make red pickled tomatoes.
But they're red and not green?
Absolutely. They are red, and they absolutely melt in your mouth.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Because I know how to do sort of kosher-style green tomatoes, which are, you know,
not
really...
At all.
No. I think I've got an idea. I have a feeling, and I'm not sure of the same thing, but, you know, the method you would use to do green tomatoes may be in, but Gus's may be applying it to how you do red tomatoes. So let me tell you what that method is, okay? Because the interesting thing about this is there's no vinegar in this pickled tomato. It's all salt. Now, this is really intriguing because this is also how you do kosher pickles, you know, cucumber pickles.
Uh-huh.
You're supposed to take tomatoes, all right, in this case, are these cut up?
No.
They're whole.
They have to be whole because if you cut them up, all the juices and everything goes away.
The deal supposedly is you put them into a sterilized big jar or a bowl, all right, you know, but something you've washed out with boiling water. And then you put enough water in there to cover them by 2 or 3 inches. All right? Then pour out that water and measure it. And for every 4 cups of water, add to the water 2 to 3 tablespoons of kosher salt and then a teaspoon each of black peppercorns and those pickling spices, you know, you can buy in the supermarket.
Okay.
They're in the spice section. It's just called pickling spices.
Yes.
Okay.
And there's a lot of garlic in this as well.
All right. 2 to 3 cloves of garlic for every 4 cups.
Okay.
Okay. Now put that in a saucepan, bring it to a boil, and then cool it.
Okay.
And then what you do is prick the tomatoes all over.
That is clearly not what they do, but okay, because the skins are whole.
All right.
There's no
sign of a puncture.
There's no blemish on the skin, because if there is, it falls apart.
That's right. Then don't prick your tomatoes, because they're red. All right, forget the pricking of the tomato. But the key here is you want to pour that brine, which is what you've now made, over them, add the garlic, and add a handful of fresh dill.
and put a plate or something on the tomatoes to weight them down so they're completely covered.
Okay.
Keep them in a cool place, even in the fridge if you want to, for about 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But after about 2 weeks, taste them. You know, take one out and taste it and see if it's where you want it. The longer you leave it, the more pickled it gets. Once you get it where you want it, you can just leave it in the bowl, or you can put it in sterilized jars with the brine and refrigerate it and keep it up to a couple of months.
Okay.
I think the key here is going to be you tasting the degree of pickle, you see, to see where it hits the point where it's right for you. And then you can always fool around with the spicing.
Okay.
You know, you can add ginger, you can add whatever you want to add or subtract if it tastes too peppery, if it tastes too this or too that.
Okay.
All right?
Well, but thank you very much.
You're welcome. And by the way, this is wonderful if you do green tomatoes with this.
Hmm.
But of course, you're going to have to use really good tomatoes. You may have to wait for summer for this one.
That's typically what I do.
Yeah, great.
Okay, thank you very much.
And what's the name of the pickle place again in the Lower East Side?
Gus's Pickles. And this is not a commercial for them, but I have ordered them by the gallon, and they airship them to me.
I'm
in Missouri.
This is very good to know. Gus's Pickles on the Lower East Side. Okay, New York City.
New York City.
And they mail order.
They mail order the phone, and I'm not sure if they're on the web, but I certainly know one year for a birthday present, my wife got me a gallon of red pickled tomatoes. That was my birthday present.
I like that. I like that a lot. Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Gus's Pickles. I think we're going to make some phone calls. Ron is on the phone. So, Ron, what do you want to talk about?
Well, hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing swell.
I like that last segment there about the pickles.
Great stuff.
I was actually calling to ask you a couple of questions about some wine etiquette. Even though I live in California and, you know, of course, there's an abundance of very good wines out here.
Right.
Occasionally, not just while dining out, but, you know, I buy them at this local store, but I do get a bottle that's unacceptable. And, you know, not too often. You know, I don't do this often. But, you know, sometimes when I'm with people, you know, a date or just company or my children especially, if I refuse a bottle, it kind of makes them a little uncomfortable. It doesn't really bother me, but I thought it might be an interesting question. And the other thing is what happens to those wines that you send back? Do they drink them in the kitchen or what?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if they end up being cooked with. Maybe the distributor takes them back. That's another possibility.
Well, I kind of thought that.
Somebody must be getting the money back on them. So what you want to know then is there a particularly proper way of sending back a bottle or refusing a bottle of wine?
Yeah, or is it just being nice and, you know, being polite? You know,
I think that's what it is. I've found people do get nervous when you do it. You know, that are dining with you. I've had the same experience you have. They kind of feel you should accept it. I found that if you're really reasonable about it and say to whoever is the person who's serving the wine, you know, this really isn't, I think there's something wrong with the bottle. What I object to as a customer is if someone really quizzes me.
Yeah.
You know, if the wine steward or the waiter challenges me and says, well, what's wrong? You know, it's a very good bottle or whatever. Then I feel like the restaurant's violated their side of the bargain.
Absolutely. I agree there.
And that's when I start getting really, you know, quite stubborn about the whole thing.
A little puffed up, right?
Yeah, because the whole idea is that we're supposed to get pleasure out of the meal. But I think the thing is, be polite. Say, you know, you're disappointed in the wine. You think there's something that's not quite right about it.
Yeah.
And could you see the wine list to look for something else?
That's true.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you so much. Love your show.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, I want to make something clear. I mean, it's really not good manners to just send back a bottle of wine because you don't like it. It's not what you expected it to be. But don't sit there when you have a bottle of wine you think doesn't taste right, that something's wrong with it. Don't feel that you don't know enough to remark about it and ask for something different. Remember, trust your palate. if you really think it's off or it's wrong or it's sour or it's spoiled in some way, just trust your palate. Rebecca's on the line. Rebecca, hi, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn, such a pleasure to talk to you. I need a way to make fish that my family will eat it.
You mean they're boycotting fish at this
point? They will not eat fish.
What didn't they like?
Let's see. I make salmon baked with dill and lemon and wine.
Uh-huh.
They didn't like that. I think it's the smell or the texture. I don't know. I do bonito bonito flakes in soups, and they don't like that.
Mm-hmm. You're adventurous. I mean, this is not you're not conservative about this. Okay, what flavors do they really love?
Let's see. Hearty. I'm Italian. They love good tomatoes. Nice, heart. We live way up in the mountains, so they need good, hearty, thick food.
Okay, all right. Let's look now. If you take that idea and you apply it to fish, okay? Mm. So maybe what you do is...
There's trout locally that we could catch.
You can get trout?
Yeah,
oh,
we can catch it
boy.
Right here.
Well, you know what, though? There is, Rebecca, this basic premise. If you fry it, they'll like it.
That's a good idea.
And what you might do is lightly bread it. With fresh breadcrumbs that you've mixed with a little bit of garlic, and salt and pepper, and maybe some fresh basil if it's coming out of the garden. And then heat up some butter or olive oil in the pan, and then quickly go, tunk on one side and tunk on the other side so you get it crisp and brown because, trout fillets are very thin. They're going to cook real fast.
Yeah.
But so it's real crunchy. And then just put that on the plate, and if you want... You have a little bit of tomato sauce that cooks on the side, and you put just a drizzle of it on the side, and you cross your fingers and hope that they'll eat it.
Yeah.
Because, if you've got great fresh trout, and fresh trout is sweet-tasting, it's not fishy at all.
See, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Something that isn't fishy.
Yeah, and well, fresh fish isn't fishy, but maybe living up in the mountains, it may be tough for you to get really great fresh fish. It's not the easiest thing in the world to get. So cashing in on the trout... makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing is, it's very simple, but trout, when it's really fresh, is wonderful just cooked in a little bit of butter. That's it. Salt and pepper and then lemon. But that may be step two with them. Try the breading it and pan frying it the way I described, and then a little tomato sauce. You don't want to sog it down, but just a little tomato sauce. And if you have to, sell it to them with a lot more tomato sauce. And then the next time you make it, cut back a bit. But if you do garlic, basil, and fresh breadcrumbs you make in the food processor from fresh bread, and you can dip them in a little egg and then in that mixture, it's got to be good.
This is my thinking. Yes, that's got to be good.
And tell them that somebody on the radio told them they should eat it.
Oh, that's it? We'll tape it.
Hey, Rebecca, lots of luck.
Lynn, you're the best.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye.
There is an exhibit at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles called The Edible Monument. And we have on the phone Marcia Reed, who is the curator of the exhibit. Marcia, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you explain what an edible monument is? What is this about?
Yes, I started working on the show because we have very large collections of books about festivals from the Renaissance through the 19th century. And these are events like Mardi Gras or special celebrations for the coronations of kings or the inauguration of rulers or the birth maybe of the king's son, a military victory or triumph, and things like that. And many times they have prints and very elaborate descriptions. I noticed that there were banquets and other kinds of events involving food, and I began to collect these, and I realized that I had quite a number of both banquets and street festivals, and I started to think it would be a very nice subject for an exhibit.
So what are the actual monuments that
are... The monuments are made of food or inspired by food. Some of them are built as very large table pieces, centerpieces, for people to admire in the course of eating and see, sort of in a state of astonishment as they come into the room. Others are meant to be taken apart and eaten themselves. Some of them were made as kind of favors or table decorations, but on a little bit smaller scale. And others were part of very, very elaborate decorations on buildings or freestanding monuments, maybe two stories high, particularly in Italy. And they were made for people to look at and then given the signal to run at and actually take away and destroy and eat in the streets.
Could you give us a verbal picture? What did some of these things actually look like?
Some of them were in Bologna and Naples, and they were called cucagna monuments or cocaine monuments. And this was about a legend of a paradise on earth where the person who worked the least earned the most, and you had mountains of cheese and rivers of milk and honey and buildings made of food that you could just go and pluck off what you wanted, maybe trees filled with birds for you to eat or little roasted fowls hanging down that you could help yourself, ponds of fish to help yourself at. It was a kind of a legend, a folk legend of the paradise on earth. They were a gift to the people of the city from the rulers, and so it was not only about an abundance, but a gift to the people, and then in sharing the food and the people accepting it, it was about a reinforcing of the community and what a good place the city was to live in.
Have you recreated any of this kind of thing in the exhibit?
Yes. When people enter the gallery, the first thing they see is an 8-foot-long tableau on a table, which is a real sugar paste centerpiece that would have been used in the Baroque period, and it's inspired by one of the manuals on cooking, which is in the show. And so it's a beautiful white temple, a domed, gilded temple with columns and balustrades, and Circe, the goddess, is standing in front of it, and she's turning Odysseus's men, who came to her island and then acted like pigs, they ate so much, she's turning them into swine. And so there's one man who's kind of on his way. He's half man and half pig. And then a couple of, they're boars, actually. They're not, you know, our kinds of cute piggies, but they're more like wild boars.
Uh-huh.
And they're wandering around between the columns of the temple. It's all in white, neoclassical, looks like plaster, but actually it's sugar paste.
It sounds fascinating. Marcia, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for your interest.
Marcia Reed is curator of the Getty Museum show, The Edible Monument. Well, thanks everybody for joining us today. Have a great week. You know, one of the greatest French chefs of the 1800s was a genius at crafting those centerpieces we talked about. His name was Antoine Carême, and I have a quote from him this week. You'll see, modesty was not his strong suit. Antoine Carême said, "The arts are 5 in number: painting, sculpture, poetry, music, and architecture, whose main branch is confectionery." Frank Urie, eat your heart out. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders and ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.